Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
A man with family lost his life, and that is an irreversible tragedy. And a hardworking police officer with a family, a man who took this job to do good, to make a difference in his home community, has now lost his chosen career. And that is a different kind of tragedy.
This week, the NYPD fired Daniel Pantaleo, the officer whose chokehold led to the death of Eric Garner. This came 5 years after Garner's plea, "I can't breathe," helped ignite the Black Lives Matter movement. While the police union denounced the NYPD's decision, Eric Garner's family applauded the move, but they say it's not enough. My guest, Paul Butler, agrees. He's professor at Georgetown School of Law and author of the book Chokehold, Policing Black Men. So, Paul Butler, remind us what happened to Eric Garner 5 years ago. And tell us why this story, even after 5 years, is not over yet.
Eric Garner was an African-American man, a father, a husband, who lived in Staten Island. He'd worked for the city for a long time, and then when there were troubles in the finances in New York, he got laid off. And we know that he apparently sold Lucy cigarettes, individual cigarettes. They're called Lucy's on the street corner. They're untaxed cigarettes, so it's illegal to sell them. So there was a market for this, including in this little park right outside the Staten Island Ferry. And so one day, Officer Daniel Pantaleo, along with others, rolled up on Mr. Garner and accused him of selling Lucy's. And he said he wasn't selling Lucy's. Other people in the vicinity that day say that he'd actually just broken up a fight. Mr. Garner was kind of a peaceable man. He was one of those good-humored kind of big guys. He was known for buying kids, he didn't know, ice cream cones when the ice cream truck rolled around. So the officers roll up. They tried to arrest him a couple of weeks before for selling Lucy's. And he was able to talk his way out of it with the officer. You know, these are B cops. They know who's doing what. And so, you know, some of these officers had seen Mr. Garner before. They knew he wasn't a dangerous type, even if some of them did think he was selling these Lucy cigarettes. So he tries to talk Officer Pantaleo out of it. He puts up his hand and said, "Oh, man, I'm not selling Lucy's. Do we have to do this today?" Officer Pantaleo interprets that as Mr. Garner resisting arrest. So he tackles him, he throws him to the ground, and then he puts his hands around Mr. Garner's neck in this illegal maneuver known as a chokehold. A chokehold is a restraining tool that some law enforcement officers use to try to get you to comply. But you can't comply, Diane, because you cannot breathe. That's why it's against regulations in most police departments. There have been a number of documented instances in which people who are placed in this chokehold die. And in fact, it was illegal to do that in New York. Officer Pantaleo has maintained that he did not use the chokehold maneuver, but all of the people who've looked at this, including the administrative law judge who ended up firing or writing the decision that authorized Officer Pantaleo's firing, they all say that he did use this maneuver. And so Officer Pantaleo puts his hands on Mr. Garner's neck. Mr. Garner says 11 times, "I can't breathe." And then he dies on the street corner. And this was all captured on videotape by a friend of Mr. Garner's named Ramsey Orta. And frankly, Diane, that's the only reason we're talking about this now, because in this tragic video, you see everything that I just described.
You see the officer holding Mr. Garner with a chokehold.
Surrounded by three or four other officers, you hear Mr. Garner say, "I cannot breathe." And you watch him expire on the street. So one of the concerns is that it wasn't just Officer Pantaleo. There were a number of other officers who were on the scene who look at Mr. Garner. And Diane, I've seen people see a stray cat on the street and express more compassion than these officers did. When it's clear that Mr. Garner is in acute distress, that's when they summon some first responders, some medical technicians, and they don't do much to help Mr. Garner either. So he's transported to the hospital, and he's pronounced dead. Ramsey Order, the young man who shot the video, is scared. He's got this tragic story caught on tape, but he's had a couple of run-ins with the law, and he's not sure what to do with it. Finally, his conscience gets the best of him. He thinks that the people have to see this. And so the video is posted on social media. The video goes viral. And that's when the Movement for Black Lives, they see this. They understand that this isn't just about Mr. Garner. This isn't just about the New York Police Department. This is a story about police violence that happens all too often. And "I Can't Breathe" becomes a rallying cry for the Movement for Black Lives. The other thing that happens all too often is the response by police and prosecutors to what happened to Mr. Garner. Just a few days later, the medical examiner in New York says that Mr. Garner's death was a homicide, meaning that it was caused by the police work. What they say is that Mr. Garner, he was a very large man. He had some pre-existing conditions, including asthma, but that asthma was triggered by the officer essentially choking Mr. Garner. And so the cause of Mr. Garner's death is homicide. The case is situated in Staten Island. Staten Island is the most conservative borough in New York. It's the home of a lot of police officers, firefighters, and retired officers. The Staten Island District Attorney, he takes the case to the grand jury. The grand jury declines to bring charges against Officer Pantaleo. Officer Pantaleo is still on the force. He's taken off the streets and put on desk duty. Mayor Bill de Blasio, the mayor, had campaigned on a platform of reforming the NYPD. Mayor de Blasio has an African-American son who he put in campaign ads the first time he was running for mayor, talking about his concerns about his young son, Dante, having to walk on the streets of New York, where the police deservedly had a reputation for not treating everybody in the community fairly, and especially not treating young African-American and Latino men fairly. And Mayor de Blasio's campaign said, we have to do better on this. And that's what got him elected. There are a lot of folks in New York who were just fed up with how the NYPD was acting. But in this case, the mayor says, well, we have to let the system proceed. And the federal government is going to take a look at this case. And the mayor said, my hands are tied. I can't do anything about whether Officer Pantaleo should remain in the force until the federal government decides whether it's going to bring charges.
And the federal government kept postponing and postponing. Why?
It took
five years.
So the case actually started during the Obama administration. And for most of the time that the case was pending, Loretta Lynch was the Attorney General of the United States. The interesting thing is that before she was Attorney General, Loretta Lynch was the United States attorney in Brooklyn. She was part of a team that brought a case against a NYPD officer for putting a man in a chokehold. The man died. Loretta Lynch headed the prosecution that convicted that officer of a civil rights violation. And so there are a lot of people in the community who were encouraged that it was now Attorney General Lynch who would get to make the decision. The career lawyers in the Civil Rights Division recommended that charges be brought, which meant that they were persuaded that they could get Officer Pantaleo convicted in federal court of civil rights violations. But the local federal prosecutor in Brooklyn recommended against charges. So we have career professionals at Main Justice recommending charges be brought. We have federal lawyers in Brooklyn saying no. Attorney General Lynch didn't make a decision. You know, a lot of people think that the idea there was that President Hillary Clinton would be next, and her attorney general would make the decision. As we all know, President Trump and his attorney general, first Attorney General Sessions and then Attorney General Barr, they had a whole different attitude about federal oversight of local police departments. And just a couple of weeks ago, 5 years after Mr. Garner was killed, Attorney General Barr overruled the career professional lawyers in the Civil Rights Division who recommended that charges be brought. And he decided that there would be no federal prosecution of Officer Pantaleo.
So then it comes to the police commissioner in New York to make the decision about Officer Pantaleo.
Yes. And so there was an administrative proceeding that was kind of like a trial in which the judge heard evidence on both sides, and then she wrote a 47-page opinion in which she ruled that Officer Pantaleo lied when he said that he had not put Mr. Garner in a chokehold, and she found that his conduct was reckless, meaning not only did he willfully put Mr. Garner in this chokehold, he was well aware of the risk that this maneuver could kill Mr. Garner, and he did it anyway.
Was the video of the apprehension and chokehold put into evidence?
It certainly was. You know, sometimes, Diane, we can believe our own eyes. In this case, that when we see this New York police officer literally choke, you know, sometimes people think chokehold, it's a police maneuver. You know, I don't have the expertise to know exactly what that is. Well, it's basically choking a person. And you put your hands on the individual's neck, and you don't take them off until he does what you tell them to do. And that's exactly what we see. And so the judge saw what the whole world saw in this video, and she basically told the whole world that we can believe our own eyes, that yes, Mr. Garner's death was caused by the chokehold that Officer Pantaleo put him in, and she recommended to the police commissioner that he be removed from the force. And just this week, the police commissioner followed that advice. Officer Pantaleo had been making $120,000 a year. He actually got a raise during this five-year period after Mr. Garner was killed. And now, for the first time in 5 years, we can say former officer Daniel Pantaleo.
Now, is it correct to believe that that chokehold had been declared unlawful by the police department itself?
In 1993, because all over the country, when police used this maneuver, suspects were dying. Again, it's really not that complicated. The idea is you restrict the person's breathing to make them do what you're telling them to do. And sometimes it works in the sense that it gets the suspect to comply. Other times, it results in serious injury or death. And so that's why in 1993, NYPD outruled it. Most other police departments all over the country tell their officers, you cannot do that. One of the concerns is that, based on what folks in the street say, the police still do this. So in the 5 years since Mr. Garner died, there have been 800 complaints to the NYPD about other cases in which officers have put people in chokeholds. 800. Again, those are just allegations. What we do know is that there are 40 instances in which the New York Police Department has agreed that officers illegally use chokeholds. And that's 40 instances since Mr. Garner's death. In 3 out of 4 of those cases, nothing's happened.
Now, what about the opposition to stepping in and saying you cannot use a chokehold? Officers' lives are in danger. Therefore, officers have to use whatever means they can to subdue a potential criminal.
So this is where we remember that what Officer Pantaleo was arresting Mr. Garner for was selling an untaxed cigarette on the street. So one question is, even if the suspect is resisting arrest, which no one should do, but if that happens, should the response be the use of deadly force? And there are a number of legal scholars and lawmakers who have suggested in cases like this, the officer do what police do in countries in Western Europe, all over the world, which is to identify the person and then to walk away. You don't kill somebody in order to arrest them for selling a cigarette on the street. And so Officer Pantaleo, he knew who Mr. Garner was. He could have walked away and, again, arrested him another time where it wouldn't have been necessary to use deadly force to make that arrest. There's also a concern about why anybody should go to jail for this. So lots of people think even if something, a minor crime like selling a cigarette, even if there should be consequences when folks do that, it should be like a ticket. Like if you speed, New York has recently made that policy for people who jump the turnstile at Subway. So folks used to get arrested for that. Now they get tickets. It's a lot more responsible because one of the concerns is, you know, when you have these very tense moments, stuff happens. And so, you know, we want to reduce these points of contact or conflict between citizens and police.
More from Paul Butler after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Paul Butler. He's professor at Georgetown University's School of Law and author of the book Chokehold, Policing Black Men. So the family of Eric Garner is satisfied that Officer Pantaleo no longer has a job. with the New York City police force, but they say it's not enough. What do they want now?
Diane, there were at least 12 law enforcement officers and other first responders who were on the scene when Mr. Garner was killed. There's now no question that what Officer Pantaleo did was against the NYPD regulations. And in fact, because of this kind of complicated New York law, when the judge recommended that Officer Pantaleo be dismissed from the force, she had to actually find that he committed a crime. And so that's what she found, and that's why she made her recommendation. Nonetheless, the only person connected to the Garner case who's gone to jail is Ramsey Orta, the young man who shot the video. He always said that he was scared to show this video, but again, he felt it was his responsibility as a citizen to shine a light on what the police officers were doing, allegedly, in our name.
Why is he in jail?
He says that that night, after the video was public, the NYPD came to his apartment building. They positioned their car so that its spotlight was shining on the window of the apartment where he lived. And he said that was a message to him: we're coming for you. Mr. Orta, like Mr. Garner, you know, he'd had some cases. He caught some cases. He had a history with drug crimes. And the police got him. He says they set him up. They say that they found drugs in his apartment. His mom lived in the apartment as well. The prosecutor said, tell you what, if you plead guilty to these drugs, we won't lock your mother up. If you make us go to trial, your mom was right here in the apartment with these drugs as well. We're going to put her in jail as well as you. Mr. Orta made that deal, and so right now, he's in jail. What the family says is there should be criminal consequences for these officers as well. That ship has sailed. Again, there's no state charges and no federal charges.
I understand that U.S. Congressman Jerry Nadler is thinking about or is going to hold hearings on possible legislation to strengthen what he calls police-community relations. What do you think of that?
You know, I think it's important that there be transparency and accountability in all institutions in government, and certainly with regard to the police, who are literally licensed to kill. I've said a number of times, police have difficult jobs. I don't have the guts, the courage to be a police officer. I respect my many friends who do that work, but with that responsibility comes accountability. And too often, with regard to police departments all over the country, they don't have that accountability. They're not responsible to the people who they are supposed to serve and protect. And so we have this breakdown in relations, especially between communities of color and police. And so I'm all for any kind of effort to transform police departments. What President Obama said in his commission on 21st century policing is that too often now cops have this warrior mentality where they look at their communities like it's us against them. What President Obama says is the better model is guardians. Police officers are guardians of the community. And if you think about it, Diane, there's a whole different resume, a whole different mindset you have if you want to be a guardian than if you want to be a warrior. And so in my book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men, I recommend that, among other things, we need a whole lot more women cops. It's proven that women officers are less likely to use force including deadly force, they're just as effective at fighting crime, at catching the bad guys, at everything we want police officers to do, but they're able to do that in a way that involves what we call a conflict resolution. They talk it out more than take weapons out, and that works better.
Tell me how policing in minority communities differs.
There's a lot of mistrust. People have different experiences. One of my buddies, who's a police officer here in the District of Columbia, says that in this very segregated city, in some ways, there are identifiably white areas and identifiably African-American areas. When he's in a white area and he sees kids, they wave. Their experience is that their mom called the officer to get the cat out of the tree. When he sees young children in African-American communities, especially east of the Anacostia River, where some of the poorer areas in the District of Columbia, kids run from this officer, they have the experience of, you're the guy who locked up my uncle. You're the guy who rolls by and gives us that hard stare. And so lots of tension, lots of distrust, lots of fear, to be quite frank. You know, I'm thinking now about these very low-income kids in D.C., but last week I had the privilege of being at this really fancy house in Sag Harbor with a buddy of mine who makes lots and lots of money. He ran a company that was very successful, and now he's retired. And he says, you know what? When I see that cop car behind me, as an African-American man, heart starts racing. I don't know what's going to happen. And so, you know, sometimes class, poverty, that makes a difference. And it certainly does here. But there's something really thick about race, about blackness and Latino-ness when it comes to interactions with the police. And so even middle-income and upper-income folks have the same kinds of concerns that, you know, our brothers and sisters who are low-income have with regard to cops.
What do you think the Garner family wants to do going forward?
You know, these are people who have become activists. I don't think they started out as all that political, but they wanted their husband, their father, their brother, they wanted Mr. Garner's death to have some significance. They wanted to push back against that lieutenant who, when the officers on the scene, when Mr. Garner was killed, texted their boss to say that Mr. Garner had died. This lieutenant, this commander in the NYPD, texted back, no big deal. What the Garner family wants the world to know is that Eric Garner's death was a big deal. And so they become very important activists in the movement with, again, tragic results. Diane, you know, we've all had experiences with the trauma that the death of our loved ones brings. Erica, his daughter, named after him, she was the face of the family. Every time there was a news conference, and every time the mayor appeared in a place to talk about criminal justice reform, she was there right in his face. Had a huge presence on social media. About 1 year ago, Erica Garner died. She was a young woman. People say she literally died of a broken heart. Her heart just stopped beating. And so, this is trauma. And, you know, I think what we all should hope for now is that the work of this family and all of the other activists in the movement for Black Lives and all the other people of goodwill who are concerned about these issues, that people like Mr. Garner, people like Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, this whole host of Black and Latino men and women whose lives have been taken by police, in a sense that these folks are martyrs, and let their deaths be meaningful. Let the tragedy of their lives at least inspire the transformation of police departments all over the country to give us the kind of transparency and democracy that we should demand from our government.
How much hope do you have that what happened to Eric Garner will truly have an impact on change in police force thinking and behavior across the country?
I want to be optimistic. Diane, I've had the pleasure of knowing you for many years, and I've had the privilege of being on the air with you lots and lots of times. So many of these times, it kind of feels like we're talking about the same thing. It kind of feels like we're asking, why does the criminal justice system treat so many people like they don't count, like they're expendable? Whether it's jailers or police or prosecutors or lawmakers, you know, why don't they give folks an even break? And so thinking about how common these stories are, that's a reason not to be so hopeful. At the same time, I think that the movement for Black Lives has inspired a movement for social justice. So when I look at other movements, like the civil rights movement, I think that they've made our democracy better. All of that took a while. And when I look at the old Jim Crow, those segregated schools and water fountains and cemeteries, it took 100 years for the law to change. Some people have described the criminal legal process now as the new Jim Crow. Well, I hope it doesn't take 100 years. But now there's a whole movement of people who just want to make our police and prosecutors really live up to what the Constitution says about equal justice under the law. I'm confident that at some point, the new Jim Crow will end, and our democracy will be better.
Paul Butler, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Today's show was produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineers are Cliff Gallagher and Josephine Neonai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.